This episode's audio was generated using AI technology.
You know, when we write code, I think we tend to trust the compiler the same way we trust, like, the physical laws of the universe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just a fundamental constant for most of us.
Right, exactly. Like, yeah. If a glass falls off the table and shatters, you blame yourself for putting it too close to the edge. You don't blame gravity.
No, of course not.
And if your code seg faults, or, you know, it just fails to compile, you instinctively assume you wrote bad code.
Right, because the compiler is treated as this ultimate objective source of truth in the engineering workflow. It's binary by nature,
which
it kind of gives us a false sense of absolute security.
Yeah.
Like, if the build passes, the logic must be sound.
But then you step into the world of modern systems programming, right? Specifically Rust. And suddenly you're forced to ask this terrifying question, what if gravity occasionally glitches?
Right. What if you drop the glass and it just floats?
Yeah.
Or worse, throws itself into the ceiling.
Exactly. Welcome to another episode of Kernel Panic. If you are listening to this, you're here because you want to get past all the surface level tech news and the marketing fluff.
Yeah, the fluff.
You want the actual, you know, code level details, the architectural decisions, and the gritty realities of shipping code.
Which is what we're doing today.
We are. Today, we're exploring this tension between Rust's expanding low-level capabilities and the sheer mathematical complexity required by the compiler to actually guarantee memory safety.
And that tension is just perfectly captured by looking at where the language stands right now. I mean, we have the Rust 1.87 release from May 2025,
right,
which is really pushing the boundaries of raw hardware control. And we're looking at that alongside some incredibly revealing empirical research on how those exact features cause the compiler's internal architecture to just, well, crack under the pressure.
Yeah, we've got a lot to unpack. So let's start with that raw hardware control in version 1.87. This release stabilizes some really highly pragmatic tools for systems engineers.
It definitely does.
Like, for instance, the stabilization of anonymous pipes with the STD IO pipe module.
Right.
Yeah. On the surface, that sounds like a minor standard library update, right? But anyone who has wrestled with process management knows the pain this actually solves.
Oh, for sure. Before this, I mean, if you wanted to seamlessly merge standard out and standard error from a child process using STD process command, you were in for a bad time.
Yeah, you were usually writing platform-specific C bindings or relying on weird OS hacks.
Or doing that awful thread juggling with blocking reads just to manage the buffers. But now it's just natively abstracted.
Which is huge.
It is. The standard library is cleaning up a lot of historical friction in this release. They even undeprecated STInt and HomeDir.
Oh, wow. Finally.
Right. It corrects a long-standing quirk in path resolution. But the most significant shifts in 1.87 are happening much closer to the metal.
Yeah, this is the stuff that really caught my eye.
So the architecture intrinsics in Distied Arch are now callable in completely safe code, provided you meet specific runtime conditions.
This is the feature that made me pause. Because previously, invoking a SIMD intrinsic, like MM256 add EP32 for vector math, that was inherently unsafe.
Right, you had to use an unsafe block.
Exactly, because the compiler couldn't guarantee that the physical CPU executing your code actually supported AVX2 instructions.
And if you ran that on older silicon, you triggered an illegal instruction hardware exception, and boom, the program crashed.
But now, if you wrap that intrinsic in a macro, like is by 86 feature detected, you don't need the unsafe block at all.
Yeah, the compiler just lets you write raw SIMD loops in safe Rust.
Which is wild, and they pushed that philosophy even further with inline assembly, right?
They did. The ASM macro can now jump directly to labeled blocks within your surrounding Rust code.
Which is a huge deal for kernel devs.
Oh, massive. If you're writing a custom interrupt handler in an OS kernel, or like building a highly optimized context switcher, you constantly need to transition out of raw assembly state back into structured control flow.
Yeah.
So being able to declare a label in safe Rust and jump to it directly from an ASM block that bridges the gap without all that intermediate boilerplate.
Okay, I need to pause here and dig into the mechanics of this, because this is where the mental model gets highly complex. We are stepping completely outside the Rust memory model.
Yep.
We're executing raw assembly or arbitrary hardware intrinsics, yet the compiler is still enforcing its safety guarantees. Let's use an analogy here for a second.
Okay, let's hear it.
It's like being handed the keys to a Formula One car that's the inline assembly jumps and raw SIMD intrinsics. But you discover the car has this magical auto-locking safety harness, which is the safe intrinsic calls.
That's a good way to look at it.
So let's unpack this. How does the compiler actually verify this safety at the instruction level when we are literally jumping out of inline assembly back into Rust? How does it mathematically prove that you checked the runtime CPU features before executing the SIMD instruction?
Well, that verification relies entirely on how the Rust compiler, Rust Currency, constructs its internal control flow graph. This pipeline is fundamentally different from a traditional C compiler like Clang.
Because Clang is a lot more straightforward.
Right, exactly. Clang largely parses your C code, builds an abstract syntax tree, and relatively quickly lowers that into LLVM intermediate representation to just start optimizing.
Right.
But Rust cannot take that shortcut. To give you that zero-cost abstraction to let you step out of the Formula One car and back in safely the compiler requires an incredibly dense front-end analysis pipeline.
And this is split into two stages.
Right? Yes, two distinct stages. Mm-hmm. You have the high-level intermediate representation, or HIR, and the mid-level intermediate representation, MIR.
So it's not just taking the syntax tree and handing it off to LLVM. There is this massive translation layer sitting in between doing all the heavy lifting.
Precisely. The HIR is where the compiler resolves the complex semantic rules. It handles type checking, trait resolution, method lookup. Mm. And then, once the HIR is satisfied that your types align, the code is lowered into MIR. Now, MIR strips away all the syntactic sugar. It doesn't care about for loops or if-let statements.
Just boils it down to the basics.
Exactly. It reduces your entire program to a fundamental graph of basic blocks connected by edges. And this is where the borrow checker lives.
Oh, interesting.
So to verify your safe SIMD intrinsic, the compiler runs a dominance analysis on the MIR graph. It mathematically proves that the basic block containing the hardware intrinsic is strictly dominated by the basic block containing the runtime feature check.
Wait, so if there is even one theoretical path around that check,
then the MIR analysis fails and the compilation is rejected, plain and simple.
And the same logic applies to the assembly labels, I imagine.
Yep. The compiler models that MIR is jump as an explicit edge in the MIR control flow graph, ensuring that the target label doesn't bypass any critical lifetime initializations.
But I mean, all this graph analysis requires an astonishing amount of computational overhead.
It's massive.
The enforcer has to track so much context that eventually it makes a mistake. Which brings us to this fascinating empirical study published in August 2025 by a team of researchers in the Journal of the ACM.
This study is incredible.
It really is. They manually autopsied 301 valid confirmed bugs inside the Rust compiler to see exactly where this architecture is cracking under pressure.
And the distribution of those bugs is highly revealing. The researchers found that nearly 45% of the compiler bugs occur in the HIR stage.
Wow, 45%.
Yeah, and about 35% happen in the MIR stage. So you're looking at 80% of all compiler defects localized in the exact intermediate layers that were invented specifically to enforce Rust's safety guarantees.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. We treat compilers like the physical laws of the universe, right? If my code fails, I assume it's my fault.
Right.
But here, this study shows that the type system itself is the single biggest root cause of compiler bugs, accounting for over 30% of all issues. We're talking about failures in trait and bound resolution, opaque types, well-formed mischecks. So I have to ask, is Rust's defining feature, its incredibly expressive type system, actually its Achilles heel?
Well, I view it as the unavoidable cost of zero-cost abstractions.
How so?
I mean, traditional compilers simply do not attempt the kind of constraint satisfaction problems that Rust deals daily. The interplay of lifetimes, ownership, and traits creates edge cases that C or C++ compilers never even have to think about.
Right, because they just let you shoot yourself in the foot.
Exactly. Consider what happens when you write an opaque return type, like returning implete iterator with a deeply nested sum trait plus a lifetime bound. You are asking the compiler to analyze the underlying concrete type, which could be this massively complex, automatically generated state machine from an async block.
Yeah, that sounds like a nightmare to parse.
It is. The HIR constraint solver has to ensure this unnameable type satisfies the trait, verify that any captured references strictly adhere to the lifetime, and prove that it doesn't violate auto traits like send or sync.
So it's spinning all these plates at once.
Right. The compiler is building a massive web of logical constraints. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those constraints form a recursive loop that ties the trait solver in a literal knot. It can actually lead to a stack overflow within the compiler itself.
Which the study backs up perfectly. I mean, it notes that ownership and lifetime errors account for nearly 14% of the bugs, while MI optimization errors make up another 15%. But a bug in the compiler's internal logic is one thing. How it actually manifests in the engineer's daily workflow is what matters.
Absolutely.
If we look at the symptoms categorized in this research, we move past the theoretical math and into real production risks.
And the symptoms are where the reality of these complex intermediate representations hits the developer experience.
Yeah.
The most common symptom, making up roughly 40% of the data set, is an internal compiler error, commonly known as an ICE.
Oh, man. ICEs. As a developer, an ICE is incredibly frustrating. You usually have to refactor perfectly valid code just to avoid the compiler's blind spot.
You just have to work around it.
But I will say, it is fundamentally safe. Your production environment is not compromised because the binary was never built. A crash is a failsafe.
That's true. It's annoying, but safe.
Yeah.
Now, beyond crashes, the study identified correctness issues at about 26%.
And what does that look like?
This is where the compiler's logic is subtly flawed, but doesn't panic. So it might reject valid code, a completeness issue, or it might accept invalid code, which is a soundness issue.
Right.
But the scenario that keeps systems engineers awake at night is the final category, miscompilations, which make up about 10% of the bugs in this data set.
This is the absolute nightmare scenario. A miscompilation means your Rust code is syntactically correct, entirely safe according to the language spec, but the compiler quietly generates incorrect machine code.
Exactly. Your perfectly safe Rust suddenly introduces undefined behavior into your production binary.
Which is terrifying. And these miscompilations frequently originate in the MIR optimization passes, don't they?
They do. While MIR is responsible for borrow checking, it's also where Rust performs optimizations specifically tailored to its semantics, like dead code elimination.
Give me an example of how that breaks.
Okay, imagine a scenario where a variable conditionally triggers a drop implementation to free memory. MIR tracks this using a Boolean drop flag on the stack.
Okay, tracking the drop state.
Right. If the MIR optimizer's data flow analysis miscalculates the lifetime bounds across a complex generic match statement, it might incorrectly conclude that a specific execution path is dead code.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So it optimizes away the instruction that updates the drop flag. Then the LLVM backend happily takes that flawed MIR and generates machine code that performs a double free on a memory address.
Wow. So you have a critical, exploitable vulnerability generated entirely from completely safe code.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is that our traditional verification tools are practically blind to it.
Yeah. Let's talk about the fuzzers, because this blew my mind. The researchers evaluated existing fuzzers against these compiler bugs, and the fuzzers only detected about 6% of the non-crash defects.
Just 6%. It's wildly ineffective.
It's like, imagine using a spell checker on an academic thesis, right?
Yeah.
A spell checker can instantly tell you if a word is fake, but it has absolutely no idea if a grammatically perfect sentence is a logical lie. Fuzzers are basically just checking the spelling. They flip bits in source code to see if the parser crashes while the compiler is failing at logic.
That's a perfect analogy. Fuzzers rely on generating random mutated inputs to explore execution paths. To uncover a MIR miscompilation, a fuzzer would have to randomly generate a syntactically perfect Rust program containing, like, an advanced trait bound, a complex lifetime annotation, and a deeply nested generic struct that satisfies the HIR type checker perfectly.
Which is statistically impossible.
Right.
The probability of a fuzzer accidentally typing out the exact semantic structure needed to reach the MIR optimizer's blind spots is practically zero. They just generate invalid garbage that gets rejected at the parsing stage.
So they never even reach the MIR stage.
Exactly. The terrifying reality is that it's the perfectly valid, intricately designed, human-written architectures that trigger these silent miscompilations.
That is so counterintuitive. The very features we leverage to write robust, type-safe systems like deeply nested traits and zero-cost generic bounds are the exact features pushing the compiler into these dangerous edge cases.
Yeah, the compiler is buckling under the weight of our own safety nets.
But the language can't just accept 10% of its bugs resulting in undefined behavior, right? The type system itself has to evolve to prevent the compiler from having to guess at these complex constraints.
Which brings us directly to the bleeding edge of this evolution. It's currently tearing up the community forums, RFC 3762, the proposal for concentrates.
Yeah, let's dive into this RFC. because the controversy around 3762 is a perfect case study in this exact architectural tension we've been talking about.
It really is. The core problem it aims to solve revolves around constdefend, basically, functions guaranteed to evaluate at compile time.
Right.
Currently, invoking trait methods from within a constbinN is highly restricted. If you want to compare two generic types using the equality operator equals equals, you are essentially calling the partial eq trait.
Which seems simple enough.
It does, but the compiler generally forbids this in a const context because it cannot mathematically prove that an arbitrary downstream implementation of partial eq won't attempt a runtime-only operation, like heap allocation or opening a socket.
So to solve this, RC3762 introduces a massive paradigm shift. It proposes the concept of a const trait, which is a trait explicitly designed to be executable at compile time.
Yes, but the friction isn't just about defining a const trait. The real debate is about the proposed tilde const bound.
The tilde const, the maybe const or const if const bound.
Exactly. When you constrain a generic type parameter with tilde const, you are instructing the compiler that the bound inherits the constness of the calling context.
Okay, so if I call it at runtime.
If a user calls your generic function at runtime, they can supply a normal trait implementation. But if they invoke it within a const context, the compiler strictly demands a const implementation of that trait.
So what does this all mean for the dev experience? Because I was reading through the Reddit threads debating this RFC, and the community pushback is intense.
Well, it's fiery.
Developers are looking at this syntax and complaining that we are just reinventing C++ line noise. Like if you're writing a math library with a struct that takes three generic type parameters and each is bounded by a trait and you want to support both runtime and compile time evaluation, you aren't just writing one simple function anymore.
No, you're defining a matrix of trait bounds that the compiler must resolve.
Exactly. The frustration is palpable. People are asking, why can't the compiler just look at the body of the trait implementation, see that it doesn't do anything illegal, and implicitly make it const? Why force developers to sprinkle tildes everywhere and explicitly map out this matrix of possibilities?
The cognitive load is undeniably increasing. I'll validate that. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the explicit syntax is a structural necessity to prevent the exact miscompilations we just analyzed.
Because implicit inference is dangerous.
Highly dangerous. The compiler must guarantee forward compatibility for trait implementations living in downstream packages written by developers you have never met. If RustMark were to implicitly infer constness based on the current body of a trait method, the ecosystem would become incredibly fragile.
Because a minor, seemingly harmless patch could just break the world.
Exactly.
You could write a trait today, the compiler secretly decides it qualifies as a const trait, and thousands of downstream users start relying on it in their compile time functions.
Right. And then a year later, you add a non-const logging call to that trait method just for debugging.
And instantly, you have broken the build for thousands of projects because your trait implicitly lost its constness.
Bingo. The foundational philosophy of Rust is that a function signature must serve as an unbreakable, strictly enforced contract, totally independent of the function's body.
Right.
If you force the HIR to implicitly guess the constness of every trait implementation across an entire dependency tree, you exponentially increase the complexity of the constraint solver. We already know the type system is responsible for over 30% of compiler bugs.
Yeah, adding implicit ecosystem-wide inference is practically begging for the solver to tie itself into knots and generate silent MIR miscompilations.
Exactly. The explicit tilde const syntax, the line noise, is a mandatory guardrail to keep the compiler mathematically sound.
It is the language demanding precision from the human engineer to maintain the integrity of the machine.
Well said.
The compiler is forcing us to do the semantic heavy lifting up front, mapping out that matrix of implementation so it doesn't accidentally optimize away a drop flag and compile our safe code into a production exploit.
The evolution of the language is prioritizing mathematical provability over syntactic convenience. As systems programming pushes further into complex compile time guarantees, the type signatures will inevitably become more verbose to capture that state explicitly.
Which brings me to a thought I just haven't been able to shake since reviewing this research. We have seen how pushing Rust to its absolute limits through safe architecture intrinsics, compile time trait resolution, and MIR borrow checking requires this unprecedented compiler complexity.
Yeah, it's immense.
And we are currently relying on developers to write perfectly valid, heavily constrained code to keep the compiler safe. But we are rapidly entering an era where AI-assisted coding tools are writing significant portions of our software.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
These AI agents do not get fatigued by heavy syntax. They don't care about Tillich-Kahn's line noise. They will happily generate massive, highly abstract, mathematically dense REST architectures filled with deeply nested generic bounds and edge case lifetimes that a human engineer would simply never bother writing.
That is a fascinating point. AI code generation is going to stress test the Rust constraint solver in ways the core team has likely never anticipated.
Right.
Because it will generate the exact kind, intricately complex, syntactically valid code that bypasses fuzzers and lands directly in the MIR optimizer's blind spots.
Exactly. If the traditional fuzzers can't find these logic bugs and humans are no longer manually mapping out the bounds because an LLM is doing it for them, are we just blindly trusting that the compiler won't buckle under the weight of machine-generated complexity?
It's a real risk.
Yeah.
The scale of the code will push those intermediate representations to their absolute limits.
Right. As AI starts pumping out millions of lines of heavily constrained Rust, these rare MIR miscompilations might go from being obscure academic corner cases to everyday production incidents.
We might see a massive spike in silent, undefined behavior.
Because at the end of the day, if gravity glitches, it really doesn't matter who dropped the glass.
No, it doesn't.
Well, thank you for joining the conversation. You've been listening to another episode of Kernel Panic. Until next time, keep a close eye on your control flow graphs and watch out for those miscompilations.